The Free Library of Philadelphia is proud to present a podcast from our author event series, recorded live at the Central Library on the Benjamin Franklin Parkway. To learn more about the Free Library, the Central Library Expansion Project, and how your contribution can help our programs and services for the community, please visit freelibrary.org. Troy Denning has written more than 19 novels, including many for the Star Wars Expanded Universe series. He is a former editor and game designer, most famously of Dark Sun, a Dungeons & Dragons game. He joins us to talk about Invincible, the final and ninth book in his best-selling Star Wars Legacy of the Force series. Please welcome Troy Denning.
How are you doing? Well, as you heard, I'm Troy Denning, and I'm just finished writing the last book in the Legacy of the Force series. So I'd like to get an idea of how many people know what Legacy of the Force is, are familiar with it, and have been reading it, versus how many people are just here to see the Star Wars guy. So if you know the Legacy of the Force, raise your hand. Okay. All right, so there's about enough that I should probably explain a little bit about the background of Legacy of the Force, which is it's a series set in the Star Wars universe, part of what they call the Expanded Universe, which is basically taking the story and expanding it outside the parameters of the films. So, for instance, in the first book that I wrote for Star Wars, it was called Star by Star. And when I started writing Star Wars, there were already about 80, you know, somewhere 60 to 80 novels that had been written before I even joined by other people, detailing progress of the story from the end of the fate of the Return of the Jedi and just carrying the story forward. Now they've gone in all sorts of directions, but I tend to write in that area. So at that time, I was writing a story in which Han and Leia were married and had kids that were 16 to 17. And now the story has carried forward to the Legacy of the Force era, in which Han is 70, but don't worry, that's the new 40 in the Star Wars universe. and their children are actually 30, which is about the age that Han was, you know, in the original Star Wars movie. So it's gone on, it's expanded and carried on quite a bit. So the Legacy of the Force starts about 40 years after the Return of the Jedi. They have children that are 30 years old. And the basic problem, the basic conflict in it, arises from the fact that one of their children, one of their sons named Jason, has turned over to the dark side. It's kind of his fault, and it's kind of not his fault. In a previous series, he had been captured by some ruthless aliens and tortured, and that kind of changed the way he looked at life, and then the way he changed the way he looked at his duty as a Jedi. And he, based on those experiences, decided that if he was ever going to bring an ultimate peace to the galaxy, there was really only one way he was going to accomplish that, and that was by becoming a Sith Lord and imposing the peace. And so at that point, he made this decision, consciously made this decision, to turn to the dark side for the good of the galaxy. And of course, this didn't go over very well with the parents, as you can imagine. And the Legacy of the Force explores the conflict that occurs between Jason and the rest of his parents and the rest of the Jedi as his powers grow and as he takes control of more and more of the galaxy. And it erupts into a full-term civil war. So that's kind of the basic history of the galaxy. I'm going to tell you a little bit about the process of writing this kind of book, and especially the one that's the final book in the series, and then we'll open it up to questions. I didn't write the whole Legacy of the Force series alone. That's 9 books in 3 years, and since I can only write maybe 1 or 2 books a year, you can see that the math doesn't add up. So there were actually three authors involved: Aaron Alston, Karen Travis, and myself. Both of our editors, wonderful editors from Del Rey and Lucasfilm. Shelley Shapiro is our editor at Del Rey, and Sue Rostoni is the editor at Lucasfilm. And then there was a support staff on both sides. There were a couple of other editors from Del Rey, and there's a continuity director and some public relations people from Lucasfilm who all came to the initial brainstorming meeting when we said, okay, we're going to write a series, a 9-book series, you know, with 3 authors, and each author is going to write, we're going to write in rotation. So I wrote, Aaron wrote the first book, Karen wrote the second one, and I wrote the third one, and then we repeated that 3 times. And as you can imagine, that's kind of an organizational nightmare. It becomes kind of a difficult thing to do. But the wonderful thing about doing it is that it doesn't really reflect on the creative process. The creative process actually is enriched by having that. So that when we sat down and started this series, we sat down and with basically just the seed of an idea that had been suggested before the series, before we were even contracted. And we sat down to develop that series, and we went out to to Big Rock Ranch, which is the new place. There used to be Skywalker Ranch. Now they've moved it to Big Rock Ranch, and then they moved it to the Presidio. So, you know, imagine having a franchise that can afford to buy the Presidio. It's pretty cool. But we went out to Big Rock Ranch, and we were going to have a meeting for one day. And when we're flying out there, I'm kind of thinking, one day to plot a whole series, that doesn't seem like enough time. And we get out there, we have drinks the night before, and we actually start to work a little bit then, just kind of bouncing ideas around. The next morning we go in, start about 9 o'clock in the morning at the ranch, and we have a meeting all morning long and just kind of tossing ideas out and shooting things down and saying, well, maybe that sounds good. And then we break for lunch, and at lunch I'm kind of thinking, man, we're never going to get this going. This just isn't going to work. But after we came back from lunch, we had kind of enough to get going and actually start generating plot points, and that's how you write a series like this. You just start writing down plot points for each book. And so we started to do that, and it's an amazing process as the ideas bounced around. You know, I would say something, and then Aaron would say, well, I don't really like that, but how about if we twist it this way? And then Karen would come in and add something. The editors would give their stamp of approval or not, and you know, anybody that was at the table, there's a list in the front of the book of everybody who was at the table, would chime in with their ideas in it. And I'm giving you an example of me doing this, but the editor might very well have been the one who came up with the idea, and the rest of us kind of talked about it and bounced it off and developed it. And I might, you know, and then the writers could have been the guys who were shooting down the editor's ideas. So that's kind of the process. You know, it's just a big brainstorming session that where everybody feels free to say what they want. We're usually pretty polite, but not always. And then it kind of becomes a very, you know, the old saying, two brains are better than one. Well, if you've got about 5 or 6 or 7 or 8, it really becomes a surprising process. You would think that it would be designed by committee and that it would just get bogged down in personalities and stuff. But that really doesn't happen because everybody's focused on what's going to be the story and they're just focused on throwing out cool ideas. And because one brain can only produce so many cool ideas, you know, a day, I guess there's a quota or something. But you have a lot of brains and, you know, they can keep going back and forth and you just develop so much more and develop the ideas so much more quickly. So by the end of that day, we had the basic outline for the series. Not everything was thought out, not everything, and it shouldn't be because you're writing it over 3 years, it's going to develop. But we had the basic core, knew where we were going basically and what we wanted to do. And then after that, we would always be going to some conventions, you know, like San Diego Comic Convention or Gen Con or something. And whenever we knew that there was going to be an editor and at least 2 writers at a convention, the third writer was kind of obligated, not officially obligated, but we just kind of said, okay, you know, you got to get there too. And then we would have a meeting at that convention. And so about every 6 months, as it turned out, we would have another brainstorming session just to develop and refine the ideas. And I got to tell you, it's a blast. It's one of the things that I've most enjoyed about writing any book, and writing especially in the Star Wars universe, because most of the time when you write a story as an author, you just kind of shut yourself up in your office, you know, down in the basement, and hope that nobody calls, and you're doing all of this alone, and you don't get to work with people, other people. And that's, to tell the truth, the one thing that kind of bugs me about being an author. I love the freedom. I love being able to be eccentric and work in my pajamas and anything like that. But I do miss having conversations. Before my wife actually started to freelance and at home and become a freelance writer herself, it was so bad that sometimes I would go to the grocery store just to see a human face. It's, you know. So it was nice to have this interaction. And then we also kept, you know, through the email, as you can imagine, the emails would fly hot and heavy as we were developing each little piece of story. So that's how the basic process worked. And then I wanted to talk a little bit specifically about Invincible, which is the 9th book in a 9-book series. And you can imagine, you've got a huge 9-book series and these tremendous family and galactic conflicts have been developing for, you know, probably, let's see, several thousand pages. So you've got a lot of stuff that you need to kind of cover, a lot of loose ends that need to be wrapped up. And when I sat down and started to write Invincible, you know, I was writing, this loose end needs to be covered up, so I was writing that one out, and then I was working on another one, and I was trying to bring all these loose ends and tie them together. And I got about two to three months into the project and had a stack of paper, you know, this thick, that just didn't seem to go anywhere. It didn't seem to have any focus. It wasn't holding the story together. So I sat down and scratched my head for a while and you know, went out on the deck and had a beer or two and just, you know, tried to think about why this story wasn't holding together. And then one day I was out there, sitting there, you know, still trying to work out, try to figure out why it just didn't feel cohesive. And then it dawned on me that it was Jaina's story. I mean, for those of you who aren't familiar with the series, I should probably give a little bit of background. In the Jaina Solo is Jacen Solo's twin sister, twin brother. You know, so the twin sisters and twin brothers. And they were very close from the time that they were young. But during the course of the Legacy of the Force series, as Jacen drifted more to the dark side, they drifted further apart. And in the 8th book, the one that directly preceded mine, Jaina Solo makes the decision that she has to be the one to take Kytus down. His name has been changed to Darth Kytus, because you always change your name when you become a Sith Lord. So she made the decision that she had to be the one to take her brother down and went off to do some special training for it. And when I was writing my book, you know, that decision had already been made by Karen Travis, and then that had been written ahead of time. So at this point, I've got that to work with, and I know that that's got to be a big part of my book. It's got to be a very large part. But the duh moment came when I said, you know what? This book isn't about all of this other galactic stuff. This book is about the conflict between Jacen Solo and his family and the Jedi. It's a very narrow, tightly focused conflict. And all of the other stuff is just spins out of that. It just comes from that. So when I had that insight one day, I just literally kind of went back, sat down, and started to write, and it all fit. It all worked once it occurred to me that, duh, the book is about Jaina, you know? So that's how the Invincible story structure came to be. And now I'm going to read you a little bit from Invincible, just a few pages. But now I've been talking about how it's Jaina's book. The section I'm going to read, Jaina isn't in. This is a section where Jaina has been dropped off on an asteroid by her parents, Han and Leia Solo, and they have Luke Skywalker with them, and Leia's, for those of you who aren't familiar with the series, Leia is by this time a Jedi Knight, and she's been trained by a lizard woman kind of thing, a Barabel, named Saba Sabatine. And she's also in this blast boat with him. And they're trying to get down to this asteroid through a flotilla of Imperial Rimnut forces. And this is kind of the story of what happens. And there's a surprising presence in there. One of Han's old enemies is actually helping them. So we'll give this a reading. And it looked like the stars just kept exploding. There would be a few moments of tranquility when the blue-flecked curtain of space hung outside the blast boat canopy, as still and stunning as the first time Han had sat in a pilot's seat. His chest would go hollow with awe at the vast beauty before him, and he would be struck by what a gift his life had been, by how much his famous solo luck had brought him, the freedom to wander an entire galaxy at will, a real-life princess for a wife, and children who made him proud, almost all of the time. Then the swirling ion trail of a starfighter would come corkscrewing out of the dark, or the luminous halo of an approaching frigate would drift into view. Boiling balls of fire would erupt ahead, like stars going nova. The blast boat would chug when Leia and Saba returned fire, and a bright, shrinking disk might flare away as Luke launched a concussion missile. R2-D2 would scroll a tactical update across the pilot's display. C-3PO would declare their imminent doom. And Han would slam the yoke to one side, diving away into the shelter of the star-dappled void. But this time, the proximity alarm broke out squawking, and crooked snakes of color began to jump across space in front of the cockpit canopy. Blue rings of ion glow formed in the dancing iridescence ahead and swelled into the backlit forms of an arriving war fleet. Almost instantly, columns of turbolaser fire began to streak back and forth between the newcomers and the disorganized remnant flotilla that had been trying for hours to keep the blast boat from reaching the asteroid. Han cursed, then checked his tactical display and saw two fleets arriving. Admiral Neothal's band of Galactic Alliance defectors and Admiral Dalla's flotilla of Imperial Era salvage. "The Conniver Sisters, 1 and 2, Han commented. "Who invited them?" "I wasn't aware that battles required invitations," C-3PO said, reaching for the blast boat's comm controls. "But we should certainly extend a gracious welcome." "You're asking me to lie?" Han asked. "No way." "I'm afraid I don't understand, Captain Solo. We are in desperate need of relief, and they clearly appear to be taking our side." "The only side those two take is their own," Han said. "They're just here because they smell blood and want to see what they can pick off for themselves." "Nevertheless, they are shooting at our enemies instead of us, which is the very definition of ally in nearly 6,000 galactic cultures. Might I suggest that now would be an excellent time to broaden your horizons?" Before Han could snap no, the intensifying brilliance of an oncoming turbolaser strike flared before his eyes. He pushed the yoke forward, then slammed into his shoulder restraints as the bolts skipped off their shields and bounced the blast boat downward. R2-D2 let out a long stream of beeps and tweedles, and damage reports began to scroll across the pilot's display. Their shields were down, a coolant line had sprung a leak, and their fusion core was overheating. "You see?" C-3PO asked. "Even R2 is frightened, and that never happens. We should request an escape vector and let them take over the fight." "Not going to happen, Goldenrod." Han spotted a flight of XJs and antique TIEs streaming away from the two fleets and dropped into their transit lane, then swung back toward Nickel One. "Not while my daughter is still down there in that rock." The frigate that had been pursuing them most recently hung in the distance, a knobby end and cylinder trailing a curved tail of ions as it turned away. Beyond it floated Nickel One itself, an inky black nugget visible only in the sense that its dark mass blotted out the stars beyond. Swarming around the asteroid were the flickering pinpoints of perhaps 100 vessels. Han opened a channel to the squadron's number 2 blast boat. "Jag, you there?" "This is dry ice, receiving you crisp and clean," came Jagged Phil's always proper reply. "Proceed." "We're going in," Han said. "You coming?" Before Jag could reply, Leia's voice came over the cockpit speaker. Going in where, Han? You know where, Han replied. But Jaina hasn't even sent the extraction code, Leia objected. We don't even know which rendezvous point. And if we wait to find out, it won't matter. Unless you can think of some way to convince Neathal and Dala to stop spooking the Imperials. Leia was silent for a moment, then said, Okay, maybe you have a point. It would seem so, Jag said. We'll join you at Extraction Point Alpha and hope for the best. A string of cannon bolts appeared out of empty space and came straight for the canopy. Han jerked the yoke up to the left, then cringed as their belly armor pinged with hits. A pair of laser beams flashed past from behind the blast boat, so close that Han felt their heat on his face. Then Boba Fett's voice sounded over the comm speaker. Right, you crazy barf! Another pair of beams flashed past, this time not quite so close. Who goes left? Han jinked to the right, then saw two sets of twin ion circles flash past as Fett and his wingmen rushed ahead to engage the blast boat's attacker. I never did like having that guy on my tail, Han muttered. He was juking and jinking so hard he had not even noticed that the belly turrets had gone quiet. Hey, Saba, you okay down there?
Okay. How can this one be okay? You are letting Fett steal our kill.
I wouldn't worry about it, Master Sabatine, Leia said. It looks like there are plenty of more where that came from. With Fett and his wingmen now taking the brunt of the attack, Han finally had a chance to glance down and see what had opened up on them. The tactical display showed a Cutlass-class corvette coming out to block their approach. Where did he come from? Han demanded. I believe he came under the frigate, C-3PO said. There may be more remnant vessels lurking back there. It might be wise to wait for support from Admirals Dala and Neathal. And let Buckethead beat us to the asteroid? Han pushed the throttles to the overload stops, trying to keep up with the Besselix. No way. Boiling puffs of color began to flower ahead as the corvette opened up with its entire bank of Bantam turbo lasers. Han swung the yoke hard left, easy right, then slammed it forward, diving straight toward a cloud of red flame that had blossomed a few centiseconds before. Captain Solo, C-3PO began. Have you forgotten that our shields are down? No. Han was already rolling away from the fireball. And don't tell me the odds, either. There really wouldn't be a point, C-3PO said. Our chances of reaching the asteroid surface without shields are too small to calculate. So now we'll open it up to questions. How are we doing on time, Andy?
We're okay. I'll tell you what, when people ask, we'll get a mic
to them. So if you want to ask a question, raise your hand. If it's a question that might spoil something in Invincible, if you know what I mean by spoil, to discuss one of the plot points, begin it by saying, okay, this might be a spoiler, and then people can cover their ears if they don't want to hear them. Okay. All right, we've got a question here to begin with, the man in the blue shirt. Okay. I'll repeat the question. How does that sound?
Okay, I was just wondering, did George Lucas get to read your book and have
I ever met him? Did George Lucas get to read my book and have I ever met him? I doubt that he read my book. He still has complete control over the expanded universe, but he's pretty busy with Indiana Jones and all of the other stuff that's going on. So I doubt that he's personally reading all of the novels. And have I ever met him? Actually, the closest I met was meeting a George Lucas impersonator in Indiana a couple of days ago, and he looks just like him. But normally he's a couple levels above where my pay grade. Yes. Okay, cover your ears if you don't want to hear it.
Whose idea was it to bring the shatter point back into Star Wars continuity? Because before then it was only Mace Windu, but now like Luke and Jaina and Jace can use it, and I really liked that special ability. Okay. So whose idea was to bring back that?
this isn't too bad a spoiler. So, whose idea was it to bring the shatter point back in? It was mine. Because one of the things that happens when you're working on a series with other authors is, you know, things kind of pop up and surprise you. And one of the things that kind of popped up and surprised me in a previous book was the Beskar Gam armor, which lightsabers couldn't penetrate. Well, that was kind of a problem for me since, you know, Jason was going to be fighting people with Beskar Gam armor. And I needed a way for him to be able to get through that stuff and to demonstrate that it doesn't make the Mandalorians invincible, you know. They're not the ones the title is naming, is referring to, in other words. So I thought about it and how I could do that and still stay within the continuity. And I had read and enjoyed Shatterpoint. And so I decided, which is a novel by Matt Stover, another Star Wars author, that some of you may know. but I'd read that novel and enjoyed it, and I remembered that, and I thought this would be a perfect technique to use, even though he talked about it as being, a lot of the time, when the way Mace used it, it was he was seeing the shatter point in a whole string, a series of events, but he also used it to see the shatter point in physical terms. And that's basically what Jason is doing and what Luke and has taught to Jaina. It's not the whole power, but at least a small part of that power, you know, is what Jaina learns. And whether or not Luke knows the whole thing, you know, that'll leave up to your interpretation. We had a question here. Yeah,
hello. I sort of missed your introduction, but just wondering, I've written some short stories like in college and that kind of thing. And I'm just wondering, how do you get started in this, or how do you know if you have a talent, say, for science fiction writing? Or because I've experimented with dialogue and that kind of thing, but I'm still a novice at it. You know, I'm just wondering what your process is and how you got into it, and are you always doing that? And what's your process day to day? You string along, or you take breaks, or
okay? Well, basically, I started to write. I became interested in writing in eighth grade when I was assigned to write a journal by our eighth grade teacher. And the way I knew that I could write and convince people that things were, you know, hold their interest was my dad happened to be the undersheriff of the county. I grew up in a very small mountain county. There were 5,000 people in the whole county, so it's pretty small. And he happened to be the undersheriff there. And I was always hearing the stories he was telling, you know, when he came home from work. So I just started to make up stories that were kind of along the same line about what was going on in the sheriff's office. You know, I just invented a cop, and then I invented, you know, what he was doing, dating the dispatcher, and, you know, and doing all this. And my English teacher, who happened to be on the liberal side of life, was reading this stuff, and he was believing that it was all real stuff, because I hadn't bothered to explain in my journal that it was fiction. So one day he gets stopped for a crime which we won't describe. And it happens to be by a deputy whose name is very similar to the name I was using in the journal. And he says, you know, you can't bust me, or I'm going to spill the beans on what you've been doing with the dispatcher. And of course he goes, what? What? You know? So after a lot of confusion, and, you know, he finally learned that this was indeed fiction. And that was kind of how I knew that I could write fiction. And I think that it comes, when you're a fiction writer, you'll have an experience somewhat along those lines. I mean, it won't obviously be quite as funny or unexpected as that one was. But you'll be show your picture, your stories to other people and judge how they react. You know, all of your friends are going to say, oh, it's a great story. But you can kind of tell whether they really mean it by the enthusiasm in their voice and by whether or not they discuss details and so forth. So that's where I would start, is I would, you know, if I wanted to find out if I have talent as a writer, I would just start showing the stories to people that I trusted their opinion, you know, whether or not they're experienced writers or not, but people whose intelligence you trust. Try to get out and find out if they really do think that you're a good writer. And you know, if your experience is similar to mine, it's going to take about, well, it took me about 15, 20 years before I published my first fiction. So it's a long process. But every time you show a story to somebody, you, if you interrogate them about what they liked, what they didn't like, you know, you don't say, did you like the story? What you say is, did you, you know, what did you like about the character? What did you not like about the character? Where did it not seem real? You ask those kinds of questions, you get good, solid answers that help you improve. And at some point, when you feel confident that you're getting enough, that your answers are, people seem genuinely to like the story, and that you're not getting a lot of comments that seem to indicate that they're bored with it, then you start submitting it. And once you have one accepted, you know, you'll, you get the idea of, well, that's how you become, you know, you start to expand your base. It's actually, it's easier these days to get a novel published than it is a short story, which is unfortunate because it's a lot easier to write a short story. But I would still start in the short stories, because if you can write a short story, you can probably write a novel. And that's how you would know, okay, this is time, it's time to step up into a broader market. Does that answer your question fairly well? Yeah, it's a, you know, probably before you're ready to write a novel, you will have written two or three novels worth of material in short stories. Short stories? Oh, yeah, I make my living at writing novels. I had a, when I began, I was a game designer for the people who produced Dungeons and Dragons. So that was where I started. I'd been trained as an editor and a writer in college. I put that to use by going to work for the people who produced Dungeons and Dragons, and that was kind of where I started writing the fiction. That was in Wisconsin. Yeah, right. Yeah. Here's a question.
I have kind of a two-part question, I guess. First, when writing a Star Wars novel, how much creative control do you have over the characters and situations, and how much is decided from Del Rey and Lucasfilm? For example, Star by Star, Mission to Mercury, and Anakin, and all that. How much of that is your idea, and how much is decided plot point-wise? And a second question, with so much going on in that universe, what kind of resource materials do you use? Do you use Wikipedia and online fan sites, or do you have specific information sent from Lucasfilm? And, you know, what do you use to do all that?
Okay. To answer the first question about how much freedom you have as a Star Wars writer, the answer is more than you think, but it varies by project. I mean, for instance, with Star by Star, we were given, they asked me to write a Star Wars novel after I had... Well, I should probably give a little bit of history. You can't just be a first-time author, send in an idea, and have Lucasfilm and Del Rey say, okay, we would like you to write a Star Wars novel. They won't even look at you until you've published one or two or three other science fiction or fantasy novels with a large publisher. So after I had done that, I'd written probably 20, 22 novels before I wrote my first Star Wars novel, and they'd all been published with, most of them had been published with TSR, or what's now known as WotC. And at that point, Del Rey, sometime during that process, Del Rey acquired the license instead of Bantam, and I figured that they would be looking for new authors, and a friend of mine who was involved with them actually said, yeah, they are looking for new authors. So I sent him an email saying, describing who I was and what I'd written, and asking if they'd be interested in seeing a proposal from me. And they said, well, just send us a sample of your work. So I sent him a sample of my work, and he called him up once a month for, or I didn't call him, I emailed him, once a month for a couple of months to see if, you know, there was any progress. And basically there hadn't been, so I just kind of said, well, it's not going to work out, and put it aside. And then 6 months later, I get a call saying, okay, we're ready to make you an offer, which is kind of out of the blue, because it was not working the way that I had expected the process to work. But in this particular case, they were working on the New Jedi Order, and they had the whole series mapped out in terms of plot points, you know, just a list of plot points for each book. And they wanted me to write one of those books, so they already had what I, in essence, would have been doing as a proposal in hand. So I had to sign the contract, and then they sent me the list of plot points to tell me what I was going to do after they've already got you locked in. And that's when I found out that I had to kill one of the Solo's children. It was kind of a shocker, to say the least, because I was a pretty good big Star Wars fan before I ever started writing for Star Wars. I had written game material for him and all kinds of stuff. So that's the way the first one went. The second one, they called me up and said, or sent me an email. When I say call me up, they're sending emails. Just make that transformation. And said, we got an idea for a book we want you to tell, Leia discovering something about her grandmother through a video diary that she kept. And that was the idea for Tatooine Ghost, and that's what they asked me to do there. At which point I did, of course, say, are you crazy? Did you read Star by Star, and you want me to write a relationship book? And they said, well, yeah, you know, you do Han and Leia pretty well, so we thought you should give it a try. And so I gave it a try, and it was a lot of fun. It was a lot of fun to write that book because it was, for a change, not something massive going on in the galaxy. It was a lot smaller focus. For the Darkness trilogy, they just said, we want you to write three books set either here or here. And that was, so all of that was just kind of what I wanted to do. The second part of the question, what kind of resources do I have? Well, we've got all of the stuff that's published, the essential guides, the Star Wars encyclopedia, all that kind of stuff. So there's a huge, vast amount of published material that I buy, you know, on a regular basis. I can get it sent to me, but I'm kind of a fan and I don't like to wait, so I just buy it. We also have a disc that they put together that just deals with continuity questions that a person at Lucasfilm is just, that's his job, is to watch continuity. That's very useful. And sometimes I do check, if I want to confirm something, I like to try to get two or three different sites. So I'll check the WOOC, and I'll also check the Star Wars Encyclopedia off of the Force.net, and I'll check some of this other stuff. And if it all agrees, then I consider it reliable. But a lot of the time, I know it. I mean, because I'm a Star Wars fan, not a fanatic, but a fan. So I've read quite a bit of the material before I ever even got a contract. Let me check on how we're doing. Yeah. Yeah. Feel free, as you're coming through the book signing, if you have any questions to ask me, then you know we can do that.
Thank you very much.
I understand that it's quite a bit. I mean, I didn't realize it was such a massive.
We'll see y'all up there.
Thank you for listening to a podcast from the Free Library's Author Event Series. If you live in Philadelphia or are planning a visit and would like to attend an author event, information is available at freelibrary.org.